Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio 91.3 FM. Reporting live for WFHB, this is Don Guerra.
And I'm Leanne Morose. This is the Daily Local News for Tuesday, September 4th, 2018.
These kinds of hate groups cannot be ignored. And we have to stand up against them and counter them and never let them rise again.
Later in the program, we'll hear from the Reverend Forrest Gilmore, who is in Madison, Indiana this weekend to counter-protest a Ku Klux Klan rally. We'll hear about the rally and counter-protests in today's feature report.
Also coming up in the next half hour, Cynthia Brubaker talks about the creation and importance of Indiana limestone in this week's edition of the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana. But first, your daily headlines.
Property annexations by the town of Ellettsville have the Monroe County Election Board questioning whether to redraw some precinct boundaries. Ellettsville has annexed 9 residential properties since the 2010 census update. All were voluntary annexations. The election board took up the issue in their meeting last week. Members agreed they'd rather deal with split precincts than tackle the state's process for changing precinct boundaries before November's midterm elections. Board member William Ellis says the county has already missed one deadline in the state's lengthy approval process.
We probably are not going to be on the top of the list to be approved for precinct changes, but who knows? But we would have till Friday, September 14th, to petition the election division. And since we missed the August deadline, we would go in after the people that submitted initially in queue. So there's 10 in front of us already.
Attorney Margie Rice says Ellettsville's annexations don't mean precinct boundaries need to immediately be changed. She quoted an Indiana Election Division memo.
And it says a precinct boundary line does not automatically change whenever a city or town annexes new territory that borders the current precinct. Instead, the county may propose new precinct boundary lines that follow the new city or town line and receive state approval for this change. However, state law does not require your county precinct lines to follow city or town boundaries. Having your precinct lines follow city or town boundaries may reduce the number of split precincts out of town versus in town for the upcoming 2019 city and town elections. As noted above, reducing the number of split precincts may decrease the chance for poll workers to provide voters with the incorrect ballot. So you might have a split situation because of an annexation, but you don't have to change your precinct boundary and it won't automatically change.
Poll workers could potentially give a voter the wrong ballot in a split precinct setting, but staff at Election Central say they have administrative controls in place to lower the possibility of error. Monroe County Clerk Nicole Brown says she'd prefer not to rush any precinct changes for the 2019 election. Board member Carolyn Vandeweel agrees.
I would go along with that. And I mean, given that it's a small number of people, I originally thought we were talking about a larger number of people that we needed to deal with. So I think we can handle this pretty well without changing anything at this point. And the census is in 2 years, so we'll be dealing with that fairly quickly.
Ellettsville Planning Director Kevin Talati says he expects voluntary annexations to continue. The election board agreed to delay changing precinct boundaries until after the 2023 census.
Requests for public safety funds from the 5 Monroe County Township Fire Departments are moving forward. In their meeting last week, the Bloomington City Council approved allocating $360,000 of 2019 public safety tax revenues to the fire departments. Bean Blossom, Richland, and Van Buren townships are being given money to replace aging breathing equipment. City Council member Isabella Piedmont-Smith sits in the Public Safety Tax Committee, which recommended the allocations. She explained the townships bulk purchased their firefighters' breathing equipment a decade ago. Now all that equipment is expiring at the same time. But she said Benton and Perry Clear Creek fire departments prioritized other needs in their funding requests.
Benton needed a water tanker. They made a persuasive case, and they had a very, very slim budget. And then for Perry Clear Creek, which is an expanding district, expanding both in revenue and expenses, we decided to focus on the one capital item that they had, which was the extrication equipment.
Piedmont Smith also explained why the Public Safety Tax Committee prioritizes funding equipment over personnel.
Now, Van Buren, just like Perry Clear Creek, had a lot of money requested for personnel, and the committee was uncomfortable in funding personnel needs because it, of course, creates an ongoing need when there's no guarantee of funding the following year from this source.
She emphasized the public safety tax was originally designed to support the 911 Emergency Dispatch Center, which serves the entire county.
Because whenever you call 911, that's where your call goes. And so having well-trained and fast responses and connections then to the emergency service providers is essential. This year is the second year of a communications program that dispatch is rolling out to the various fire departments in the county, including the township fire departments, to make sure everybody has the same high-quality radios and uses the same frequencies, and also has mobile data terminals at their disposal so they can get updates while they're en route to the emergency scene.
Last year, the Public Safety Tax Committee chose not to fund any township requests.
But that doesn't mean the townships didn't benefit in this 2018 budget year, because they received the benefit of those communication investments that went through central dispatch. And some things do need to be centralized just to make sure all the pieces work well together.
Current projections indicate the 2019 public safety tax revenues could total $8.3 million. Emergency dispatches allotment, along with the allocations to township fire departments, are taken off the top. The remaining tax revenue is distributed to the four members of the Monroe County Income Tax Council. Those are Monroe County, the Town of Ellettsville, the Town of Steinsville, and the City of Bloomington. Councilmember Susan Standberg has served on the Public Safety Tax Committee since the tax's inception 3 years ago. She said the additional township allocations cut into other public safety funding, like for PSAP, as emergency dispatch is sometimes called.
Any amount of money that is funded to these additional applications that are outside of the funding bodies that are part of the jurisdiction does take off from the top monies that could be going to the PSAP or the other four units, City of Bloomington, Monroe County, Steinsville, and Ellettsville. And so these things have to all be carefully weighed, and there is great need all across the board when it comes to this equipment. It's expensive, and it does have a limited lifespan, and there's a real serious need all across the board for public safety. So this local income tax is a real gift for us to be able to have to allocate at all. And again, as all of us have gone through the budget hearings last week, and we hear from police and we hear from fire, their critical needs, it does take a little bit of effort to ponder the priorities. I do hope that in the coming round of the PS Lit, we can maybe come up with some criteria that will make some of these township asks a little bit more consolidated, a little bit more predictable.
The Bloomington City Council carries the most votes of all the members of the Monroe County Income Tax Council. Its approval of the township allocations essentially assures approval by the Income Tax Council.
More students are now enrolled at Indiana University than ever before. WFHB correspondent Annie Aguiar brings us that report.
The largest freshman class in Indiana University's nearly 200-year-old history enrolled at IU campuses statewide this fall. According to a press release from IU, freshman enrollment across the seven IU campuses is larger than it's ever been before, with a record-setting nearly 16,000 students. IU spokesperson Chuck Carney says, despite the record enrollment, IU did not accept more students this year.
It does so happen that we have a record number, but that is really because we had more people who said yes to the opportunity to come be a student at IU.
In addition to being the largest incoming class in IU's history, incoming students will join a more diverse student body. IU reports the number of minority degree-seeking students on campus has doubled since 2007. Minority students now number over 20,000 at campuses statewide. That's almost a quarter of IU's degree-seeking population. Record numbers of Latino and Asian American students are studying at IU.
Well, I think we have quite a few efforts that really reach out to try to make sure that students who are from underrepresented groups and maybe first generation as well are not just recruited to campus, but when they get here, they're given the tools that they need and things that will help them succeed here.
Carney says an ongoing concern for IU enrollment remains international student populations. International enrollment at IU campuses dropped nearly 6.5% this year. IU's not alone in having difficulties attracting international students. American higher ed institutions are having trouble recruiting foreign students across the country. For WFHB, I'm Annie Aguiar.
President Trump was in Evansville on Thursday of last week. As WFHB correspondent Gabe Donnelly reports, the president stumped for Indiana Republican Senate candidate Mike Braun.
Republican nominee Mike Braun will face incumbent Democratic Senator Joe Donnelly in what is considered one of the nation's most competitive races. During his speech, President Trump continued to criticize the news media, calling out the New York Times, among other news outlets, before speaking on behalf of Braun. The president was met with both supporters and protesters at the Ford Center in downtown Evansville on Thursday. During the Make America Great Again rally, a Trump volunteer attempted to block a photojournalist shot of anti-Trump protesters. Reuters photojournalist Kevin Lamarck says Trump campaign volunteer Nick Barbnecht attempted to block his shot of protesters. Barbnecht was reportedly assigned to supervise journalists in the press pool during the rally. Another photojournalist captured Barbnecht covering Lamarck's camera lens. Associated Press photographer Evan Vucci captured the moment. Vucci's image was picked up by national news media organizations over the weekend. The Trump campaign initially did not comment on Barbnecht's attempt to block the photojournalist, but has since removed him from the campaign. Barbnecht has since apologized. President Trump has called the news media enemies of the American people at least 8 times on Twitter alone since June. For WFHB, I'm Gabe Donnelly.
Reporting live for WFHB, I'm Don Guerra.
And I'm Leanne Moroz. Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com.
The KKK held a rally in Madison, Indiana over the weekend. Bloomington resident and Shalom Community Center director Forrest Gilmore was among area residents to attend counter-protests at the Southern Indiana rally. WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaks with the Reverend Forrest Gilmore in today's feature report.
Reverend Gilmore, what can you tell me about what exactly happened over the weekend with regards to this KKK rally?
I first heard about it through an article on Facebook that was telling people that it was happening, that was kind of letting people know that there was a KKK rally going on in Madison, Indiana, and immediately felt a need to respond and to provide some kind of alternative counter-protest. Shortly after that, I saw a couple of different local groups and actually one local group and one group of people of color that were organizing specific events as counter rallies to the KKK rally. So I decided to jump in on them, on those counter rallies and support those groups.
Can you describe what it was that you saw there?
It was around noon, and we showed up there, and honestly, there were fences all lined up around this small park. There was about 40 or so police officers, sheriff department, all kinds of different law enforcement folks there, blocking about a dozen KKK members who were standing in the park, all with most of them with masks over their faces and kind of yelling and shouting white power. And there was about 300 or so counter-protesters there just responding, yelling back as well as having some, speeches and PA system stuff going on. It was loud and a lot of protests, a lot of different ways of people protesting, but it was a pretty loud
couple of hours there.
As you had mentioned, this went on for a couple of hours. I understand that the KKK members dispersed around 3 o'clock. Can you tell me, 300 people is a lot of people to show up for a counter rally. Were these mostly folks who were people of color or folks from local communities or, like yourself, folks from all over the state traveling in? Who all did you meet there?
Yeah, it seemed to be at least organized by two main groups. One was a local Madison group that really wanted to say no hate in our town. And they organized some speeches and then walked off to another park that's in more of the African-American part of town and had a kind of a gathering and a rally and a picnic over there, I think. And then there was an AIM protest, American Indian Movement protest, there as well. And they stayed behind. They didn't walk to the park. They stayed behind and continued to stay there as long as the park was occupied by the Klan. And most of the group I was with stayed behind to stay with AIM and their supporters. It was mixed. There's a lot of there were people of color as well as white people there responding. So it was a good mix of different groups there.
And what was your message, or you and other people that you came down with? What was the message that you either did you shout to the Klan, or were you there for other counter protesters? What exactly was your message at this time?
I mean, the biggest reason we were there was to say a big no to racism, to white supremacy, to the hate and the violence of the Klan, both historically and currently, and what, you know, could be, planned for the future as well. These kinds of hate groups cannot be ignored. And we have to stand up against them and counter them and never let them rise again.
At any point, did this get heated, or was there any kind of fear for safety, or did the police end up stepping up at any point?
So it was heated the whole time. It was loud and a lot of yelling all around. So it was a pretty heated event the whole time. There were tons of police officers and fencing that kept the two groups apart from each other for the most part. So there was no physical interaction between the two groups almost at all. There were a few instances where some Klan supporters arrived later or came to help some of the Klan by bringing them water and things like that. Or there were a few people that joined late. And so there were some moments of tension as they kind of moved into the park. But there was no physical interaction and no physical altercations at all. I think the biggest, what I really want people to know is that racism is real, that white supremacy is real, it's strong, it's powerful, it continues to be an awful part of America, and that everyone, all of us, are called to stand against it and to fight it, to stop it, to prevent it from growing, to shrink it down to nothing. And I think in particular, white people need to really take this seriously and support people of color and the efforts to end racism in our country and elsewhere.
And is this your first protest action against or counter demonstrating against Klan members or hate groups?
Not against hate groups, but this is the first counter rally I've been to around the Klan, you know, with the Klan in particular. But certainly there's no absence of opportunity to counter protest these folks and what they're offering. Especially, it just seems like it's gotten more and more intense, more and more support for this kind of stuff, and there really needs to be a response to shut it all down.
Reverend Forrest Gilmore, thank you so much for speaking with me.
That was WFHB News Director Wes Martin speaking with Reverend Forrest Gilmore about counter-protests to a KKK rally in Madison, Indiana this weekend. Support for WFHB comes from listeners like you and from the IU Health Foundation, where local gifts stay local, serving patients for a healthier Bloomington.
Coming up next, the Bicentennial Journal, looking back on 200 years of history in South Central Indiana.
Monroe County's Bicentennial Committee presents the Bicentennial Journal, stories celebrating the rich history of Monroe County.
This is my Monroe County story. I'm Cynthia Brubaker, an architectural preservationist, and I have been studying the importance of limestone in our community since I arrived in 1986. There are three aspects to my study: the limestone buildings around the square, the fact that the limestone industry is family-based, and the fact that our limestone industry is unique to this area, the only place in the United States with this quality of building stone. I will speak first to the presence of limestone buildings around the square and in town. Many buildings sprang up at the peak of the limestone industry and the peak of the building boom in Monroe County and the country in the 1920s. The Wicks Building on the north side of the square now has a nail and hair salon on the ground floor, and it has a lovely limestone veneer on its outside. The former J.C. Penney's building on the west side of the square now has Goods for Cooks on its ground floor, and the former Kresge's building now has The Tap on the corner of College and Kirkwood Avenues. The buildings from the 1920s use limestone as a veneer, whereas the older buildings still use limestone as a weight-bearing stone, which means that large blocks of stone were built up to support the weight of the upper stories of the building. Older examples are the Knights of Columbus building, which now houses apartments upstairs and a sports clothing store on the ground floor. Williams Jewelers was on the ground floor for many years. And the courthouse itself is built out of limestone. If you look around the Monroe County Courthouse Square, you see 70% limestone construction, whereas most courthouse squares in Indiana and elsewhere have a lot more brick in their construction. On campus, a majority of buildings make use of limestone. And around the country, buildings such as the National Cathedral in Washington, D.C., the Empire State Building, the Pentagon, and Rockefeller Center in New York feature Indiana limestone on their exteriors. Indiana limestone was used extensively in rebuilding Chicago after the Great Chicago Fire. The limestone industry is family-based because it is geographically based. Technically, it's Salem limestone, and it's found in a belt from Steinsville in northwest Monroe County to Bedford, south of Bloomington in Lawrence County. The belt is from 1 mile to 10 miles in width. Some of those family names you may have heard of are Hoadley, Matthews, Bybee, Reed, Elliott, and Evans. The Matthews Cutstone Company is a historic one. It was established in Ellettsville in 1862. It was purchased by Wilbur Bybee in 1979, and it maintains its historic mill, office, and drafting buildings, which were restored by the current owners, the sons of Wilbur Bybee. Our limestone industry is unique to this area, the only place in the United States with this quality of building stone, known as dimension stone, which means it's desirable because it has no grain, it's the same in all directions, and that means it can be cut and used in a myriad of ways. Sometimes you can even see little sea creatures, as it was formed in the Mississippian age when this area was a vast sea. The first recorded use of cut Indiana limestone was at the early part of the 19th century for the foundation and sill of the mainly brick Second Monroe County Courthouse. The first commercial quarry was in 1827, and a year later in 1828, we have the first house built entirely of Indiana limestone and the oldest standing house in Monroe County. That's the Daniel Stout House on Maple Grove Road. In the 19th century, steam was used to power the equipment that was used in the industry, but by the 20th century, electricity came into use. By the end of the 19th century, the industry became more of a fabrication industry where mills are in use, not just a quarrying enterprise where the rock was being taken out of the ground and shipped away. By 1928, we have the high point of the industry with 14.5 million cubic feet furnished by Monroe and Lawrence County quarries. You can still see some of those cubic feet of stone all around you here in Monroe County.
Join us next week for another edition of the Monroe County Bicentennial Journal.
Support for the Bicentennial Journal and WFHB comes from Monroe County and Visit Bloomington. More information about Monroe County's Bicentennial is available at monroecounty200.us.
You've been listening to the Daily Local News on WFHB. Today's headlines were written by Annie Aguiar and Gabe Donnelly, along with Sarah Vaughn for Cats Week, a partnership with Community Access Television Services. Our feature was produced by Wes Martin.
The Bicentennial Journal is produced by Kate Welch with help from Joyce Poling. Our engineer is Tal Rothenberg. Our theme music is provided by Ben Lumsdaine, Scott Schmadke, and Danny Graff. Executive producer is Wes Martin. For WFHB, I'm Leanne Murrows.
And I'm Don Guerra. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org.
You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@wfhb.org.
Stay tuned for Counterspin, Fairness and Accuracy in Reporting's weekly radio show, providing a critical examination of national headlines. That's coming up next on WFHB.